31. Secret Machineries. She did her best to put away the clinging unease after the conversation with Heidi, put on hose, the dress she'd brought, shoes, makeup. The bathroom was no more than a sort of alcove, less floor space than the Wellesian shower and cabinet. Worrying about Gareth's safety, she'd wisely told herself when they'd started, was something best not begun, lest it never end. Doing very dangerous things was his avocation. Where he lacked the bits and pieces of income afforded a retired musician, once somewhat popular, he had the old man, looking not unlike the later portraits of Samuel Beckett, eyes of a similarly startling ferocity, possibly mad. The old man, who had supposedly once been something, never specified, in the American intelligence community, was Gareth's producer-director in an ongoing sequence of covert performance art pieces, financed, she'd been allowed to dimly gather, by other retired members of that community. Some rogue geezerhood, evidently brought into focus by a shared distaste for certain policies and proclivities of the government. She'd never seen him again, after Vancouver,
but he'd remained a background presence throughout her time with Gareth,
like a radio playing quietly in a nearby room. The most frequent voice on any one of Gareth's short-lived phones. The old man would not, Hollis imagined, have approved of their involvement, but the multi-skilled Gareth would have been impossible to replace. A man whose idea of fun was to fling himself off skyscrapers in a nylon suit with airfoil membranes sewn between the legs and arms to thighs. A human flying squirrel amid lethally unforgiving uprights of glass and steel. None of that had been Hollis at all, as Heidi had pointed out at the time. Not her taste ever. Athletes, soldiers, never. She'd favored art boys, of any stripe, and unfortunately the dodgy hybrids as well, art boy businessmen, with personalities as demanding as ambitiously crossbred dogs. That was what she'd known before, and in various generally unhappy ways, had understood. Not base-jumping madmen from Bristol, who wore turtlenecks without having to first consider the implications, and quoted the less popular poems of Dylan Thomas in their entirety, because, he'd said, he couldn't sing. All while scrawling graffiti on the secret machineries of history. Gareth, whom, she now obliquely accepted, in the descending bronze elevator booth, she did truly love. Repacking this swiftly, however, before the jolt announced the Odeon's lobby. She was wearing the hounds, open, over her dress, hoping that its darkness might allow it to pass for a sort of bolero. How many seasons until this kind of mismatching would read on her as bag lady, she wondered. That worry would be Biggins, she guessed, and his talk of aging bohemians. Nodding to the man at the desk, who was reading a novel, she popped the jacket's collar, producing a faint jungle whiff of indigo, which she left to hover in the hotel's lobby. Outside, the air had been scrubbed by rain, pavements glittering. 10 to 8, by her iPhone. She could, as either George or Meredith had said, see laissez-détour across the way, not this street but the next one over, angled. She walked right, past the fancy little drugstore, then right again, not wanting to be early. This much narrower street, angling sharply back behind the hotel, was home to an English-language second-hand bookshop, a cocktail bar, a serious-looking sushi restaurant, a bookbinder, and a place that seemed to specialize in Chinese reflexology equipment, sadistic-looking massage devices, instruction manuals, models of bodies and body parts marked with meridians and pressure points. Here, for instance, was a very large China ear, apparently identical to the one in Heidi's room at Cabinet. She'd known she'd seen one before. She turned, walked back to the bookbinder's smaller window, wondered about its clientele. Who paid whatever this cost to have old books rebound? To this highest standard of workmanship, exquisite cobbling for ancient thoughts? Big End might, she supposed, though any bibliophile tendencies of his were well concealed. She'd yet to see a book in any Big Endian environment. He was a creature of screens, of bare expanses of desk or table, empty shelves. He owned, as far as she knew, no art. In some way, she suspected, He regarded it as competition, noise to his signal. One of the books in the window was shaped like a fan, or like a wedge of gilt-embossed ivory calfskin pie, the apex bitten neatly, concavely off. The street was completely deserted. She said a silent prayer for Gareth. To what? She didn't know. Unreliable universe. Or those machineries upon which he painted. Please. The book fan regarded her smugly, immaculate, its contents unread perhaps for centuries. She turned and walked toward Odeon, crossed it, continuing on toward the restaurant. Outside of which, some residual celebrity sense now told her, were paparazzi. She blinked, kept walking. Yes, there were. She knew the body language, that nervy but negligent pretending not to care, a sort of rage, born of boredom, waiting. Untouched drinks on the red tablecloths, whatever was cheapest. Phones to ears, a few with sunglasses. They watched her approach. Instinctively, she waited for the first one to raise a camera, for the sound of machine-driven image collection, tightening the muscles in her pelvic floor, prepared either to flee or look her best. Yet no one shot her, though they watched as she came on. She was not the target, had not been for years. But temporarily, a person of interest now by virtue of turning up here? Why? Inside, Les Editeurs was deco, but not the chrome and faux onyx kind. Red leather, the color of 50s fingernails, mid-brown varnished wood, books by the yard, framed black and white portraits of French faces she didn't recognize. "He didn't need to send you," said Rausch, her one-time editor on Big Ann's non-existent node, the phantom digest of digital culture. "It's all going very smoothly." He was glaring at her over the tops of heavy black frames, glasses that looked as though they had been cranked almost shut around whatever would be left of his field of vision. His black hair looked as though his skull had been flocked. "No one sent me. What are you doing here? If he didn't send you, why are you here?" "I'm meeting someone for dinner. In Paris. On Hubertus's business. But nothing to do with you. Your turn." Rausch palmed his forehead, ran fingers exasperatedly back through locks he didn't have. "Frederica, the daughters. They're launching the new album this week. She's here with Bram." He winced, reflexively. "Who's Bram?" "Bram from the Stokers. It's that vampire thing." He actually looked embarrassed. "Ides is supposed to have been hot for him. Now he's with Frederica. In the States, people's taking Frederica's side. Us is Ides. Over here, we don't have that clean a break yet, but we should by tomorrow."
"Isn't that tactic kind of ancient?"
Rausch twitched. "Biggin says that's the point. He says it's a double reverse, so corny it's new. Well, not new, but comforting. Familiar."
"Is that why he's always with them? Their Blue Ant clients?"
"He's tight with their father," Rausch said, lowering his voice. "All I know."
"Who's their father?"
It seemed odd to her that the twins had a father. She'd thought of them as having been decanted from something. "Big deal in Iceland. Seriously, Hollis, he really didn't send you?"
"Who decided they'd come here?"
She'd spotted one twin's silver hair across Les Editeurs, but she'd already forgotten which one Rausch had said was here. Seated at a table with a tall, broad-shouldered young man, very pale, one eye concealed by a heavy, dusty-looking flop of black hair.
"I did. It's not too hip. Looks like they chose it at random. Won't detract from the narrative."
"Then unless one of the people I'm having dinner with is a Big Ant plant, it's a coincidence." Rausch glowered at her, which actually meant, she knew, that he was frightened.
"Really?"
"Really." Maitre D. hovering now, impatient.
"Overton," Hollis said to him. "Table for four."
When she turned back to Rausch, he was gone. She followed the man through the crowded restaurant to where George and Meredith were seated. George half rose, doing the air kiss thing. He was wearing a dark suit, no tie, white shirt. A small triangle of ultra-dense chest hair at the open collar made it look as though he were wearing a black t-shirt. She thought his stubble had lengthened since she'd last seen him. He smiled ruefully, white teeth seemingly the size and thickness of dominoes.
"Sorry about this. I had no idea." I actually chose the place so we could talk and not be distracted by the food.
He sat back down as the maitre d' held her chair for her. When he'd gone, leaving thickly bound menus, Meredith said, "We could have been across the street, a comptoir. That would have distracted us thoroughly."
"Sorry," said George. "The food here is rather good. Unfortunately, it looks like poor Bram's the main course."
"You know him?"
"To speak to. He's talented. There but for fortune, I suppose."
"Studio time with Reg not looking quite so dire?"
"Not since our conversation this afternoon, really."
Big solid teeth appearing again. She could certainly see why Meredith liked him. Indeed, she could see that Meredith very definitely did. They gave off that contact pleasantness she expected from couples who liked one another in some genuine but non-manic way. She wondered if she'd ever been half of one of those. "Your friend is with Fredrika Bronstadter," she said, the name coming back.
"Evidently," George agreed.
"Not in any biblical sense, I hope," said Meredith, peering over her open menu at the Bram Bronstadter table.
"None whatever," said George. "He's gay."
"That must make it even more embarrassing," said Hollis, opening her menu.
"He'll do what he has to," said George. "He's looking for a way out of the vampire thing. Tricky."
Milgram appeared, his hair looking damp, the maitre d' fussing officiously behind him.
"Hello, Milgram," Hollis said. "Have a seat."
Assured that Milgram was meant to be there, though clearly none too pleased to have him there, the maitre d' retreated. Milgram unslung his shoulder bag, lowered it to the floor by its strap, beside the remaining chair, and seated himself.
"This is my colleague, Milgram," Hollis said. "Milgram, Meredith Overton and George. Like you, George has only the one name."
"Hello," said Milgram. "I saw you at the clothing show."
"Hello,"
said George. Meredith looked at Hollis.
"Milgram and I," Hollis said to Meredith, "are both interested in Gabriel Hounds."
"Unidentified flying objects," Milgram said to George. "Do you believe in them?"
George's eyes narrowed beneath his unibrow.
"I believe that what appear to be objects, flying, sometimes appear to be seen, and may be unknown."
"You haven't seen one?" Milgram leaned sideways and down to scoot his bag farther under his chair. He looked up, from very close to the tablecloth, at George.
"Yourself?"
"No," said George, with careful neutrality.
"Have you?"
Milgram straightened up, nodded in the affirmative.
"Let's order, shall we?"
said Hollis, quickly, hugely grateful for the arrival of their waitress.